Gosh, Betty, Jack is in serious trouble. Shall I go get Uncle Jim?
Oh, never mind, Billy. You know Uncle Jim can't help Jack. Jack does everything for himself.
And so, with Jack doing everything for himself, we leave the adventures of Jack Armstrong from 1939 or 33 or 46 and move to 1970. And at our table at Sage's East, we have John Gannon, who played Billy Fairfield on the Jack Armstrong Show, and Sarah Jane Wells, who was Betty on the Jack Armstrong program. Sarah Jane, what is the most vivid recollection you have of the Jack Armstrong program?
Oh, I think possibly in the long run, what I remember most is the hard work and the tremendous amount of fun that we had. A happy combination of two things.
It's wonderful if you can combine hard work with fun.
Well, we did.
You were Betty for how long?
For, 34 to 47, however much that is.
Just about the entire run of the program, right?
Well, pretty much.
And John Gannon, you played Billy Fairfield.
Well, I started in 33. Sari had she played a heavy at first, Gwendolyn Duvall.
I was the villainess for the first
and,
6 months.
After a few months, Sari became Betty. But when I came to the program, it was on about the 46th episode. The cast had already gelled. Ameech, Jimmy Ameech, and
yeah.
David Owen, the director, and Sari, and Bill Myers, Stan Andrews. Bob Andrews, incidentally, was the author, although I never saw him. He just left and went to Hollywood and wrote a thing called If I Had a Million, which is a great classic movie. And he invented Jack Armstrong because General Mills was sick of paying a fortune to Percy Crosby for Skippy. But I came into a cast, for the use of the name, I came into a cast that had already gelled and replaced Junior McLean, who went on The Air Adventures of Jimmy Allen, which lasted 2 years. But Sari and all these people were pros, and I was just an office boy, and I hung in there for a while, but they really knew what they were doing.
Well, I want you to know that all of us who used to, you know, sit on the floor in front of the radio with that one with the flickering green eye,
yeah,
we could identify, best of all, the fellas with Billy, and the girls could identify with Betty, because they were our kind of people. You see, Jack was a hero, and Uncle Jim was the so-called the guiding light of this adventure, and the guiding light is another story altogether, too.
Well, of course, I should have said Jim Goss was our best, I think, Uncle Jim.
Right.
Jim Goss was a wonderful experience for any youngster to know, and I would hope that other people growing up would know as fine a guy as Jim Goss. And just a charming person.
That's a wonderful tribute. That's a wonderful tribute. We mentioned Guiding Light a moment ago, and you, Sarah Jane, played Mary Rutledge.
That's
in
right.
Guiding Light,
I
right?
I succeeded Mercedes McCambridge, who was Mary Rutledge first. And when she left the show, I took over the part and played it until I went to California. And I was in other Erna Phillips shows, too.
Right. You played Louise Timms in The Right to Happiness.
Right.
And Claudia Wilson on Road of Life.
Well, where did you get your notes? My word.
Well, you played two characters in The Woman in White, Gladys and Eileen Holmes.
No, I didn't do Gladys. No, someone else
didn't.
Played Gladys. I was
Eileen. Well, I wonder
where
Eileen. I did get this information.
I was Eileen, who was The Woman in White.
What about those days? You often did two. You were doing two, three, four different programs at a single time, right?
Well, we would go from one. We would rush from the Merchandise Mart to the Wrigley Building and over to do recordings and back again. And it was a rat race in a sense, but it was an exciting experience. And we always made our commitments on time.
Yes, sir.
What I'd like to say is, in this day when no actor is really making the money that he should in Chicago, and as I told you earlier, I'm a Johnny One Note. There was no place in the industry for me. But we worked for an advertising agency, Black & Sample & Hummer, that originated more network commercial time in Chicago then all of the advertising agencies in the United States originated in Hollywood and New York combined. Actors used to come to Chicago because girls like Terry and the others were making radio so popular. But here was one, the Chicago field office of Black and Sampson Hummer did more network commercial time in the middle 30s out of Chicago than everybody in New York and Hollywood combined.
That's amazing. Chicago really was
that was the heyday of Chicago radio, and it was the mecca of radio because, for instance, many film stars, later film stars, were here, played in radio programs with us, and then went on to other things. Johnny Hodiak was a dear friend of ours.
Yes.
And was playing a hillbilly character in Chicago radio when he finally got the
played
right
Little Abner.
Ball. You played Little Abner, that's right.
Well, you had... when did Chicago go downhill, so to speak, as far as radio? When did the actors and the programs move to the coast?
Well, first of all, the agencies decided to move the programs. Isn't that
right,
Johnny?
Yes, sir.
And when the agencies take their programs with them to one coast or the other, that leaves a kind of a desert. And while radio is still important here, certainly the... There was a great outgoing of actors from Chicago because of this.
There were so many pieces in the mosaic. For instance, you take an agency man. He didn't want to come to Chicago in the dead of winter. If he went to New York to see a show, he saw the Broadway shows. If he went to Hollywood, he played golf. If he came to Chicago, he wore his overshoes. But there was a domino theory. When one show moved, it took the star. And then because the star went, maybe the announcer would go with it. Well, then there'd be that less talent. And pretty soon it became, I only know one little part of it, and I'm not trying to explain it all, but it also became cheaper at that time for the networks to operate two major places instead of three. And that figured. And pretty soon we had Hollywood and New York, and pretty soon we didn't have any radio at all.
So Chicago lost its place at the top of the radio talent system just because of bad weather.
There's so many pieces in the mosaic,
right.
Yes.
And furthermore, there was a kind of charisma about that period that never existed in radio or television in any time before or after. And it was a singular kind of Chicago experience that no other city has had.
Well,
do you agree?
100%. For instance, we used to have a little club called, I bet you haven't thought of this in years, Terry. Little Mother's Pouring Circle.
Let me tell
you about Little Mothers. We'd meet in Henrici's on Friday afternoon. The rules were if you rapped anybody, it cost you a dime. Everybody bought their own drinks. Anybody could come, and we'd start with a table for four, like us, like we're sitting here. And as people came, there'd be a long serpentine table. There might be 30 or 40 Little Mothers. And then all of the conversation on Thursday in the Wrigley Building and in the Wrigley Bar and in NBC would be, are you going to Little Mother's? We had our own cards, membership cards. But the beauty of it was that if a gal didn't have a guy, she could still go to Little Mother's on Friday at 4:30 or 5. Or if a guy didn't have a girl, if a guy was Cap City, he'd go there with a dollar and buy one drink because nobody was allowed to buy anybody else a drink. Except a man could buy his wife. But nobody ever had a big shot and buy for the table because there might be 20 or 30 people there anyway. So we had this Little Mother's Pouring Circle, and Sari belonged to the prior club, which I didn't, and that was called the Almost Every Other Saturday Afternoon High Wheel Bicycle Club. And you forgot that.
No, I have never forgotten that. Never.
Little Mother is pouring great memories this evening, aren't they? It's really great. We really appreciate your being with us today. Thank you so much, Sarah Jane Wells, who was Betty and Jack Armstrong, and so many other wonderful radio personalities, radio characters, and she's a wonderful personality, too, and John Gannon for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is John Gannon, who played Billy Fairfield on Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. And, John, tell us something about the... one of the reasons why sponsors and kids' adventure programs use radio premiums, you know, pedometers and whistling rings and so forth.
Of course, it was to build a product. It was our pride that while some of the people on our cast might be members of the Shirley Temple fan club, all of them weren't, and yet Shirley was a member of our fan club out in Los Angeles. But the giveaways were a wonderful way of getting the children to try the product and to listen to the program. I just saw a man with what we called a hikometer. It's a metal device, it's a pedometer, and it costs you a quarter and two box tops. That device established Wheaties as a national product and established the Jack Armstrong program as a national program, whereas before that time, we had just had the key stations of the network. And the reason for that was, when we were giving away that product, General Mills found out that the whole pipeline supply of Wheaties to the areas where our program was heard was empty. In adjoining market areas, they had all the Wheaties they needed. Now, I've had this conversation with the late James Ford Bell Sr., who was chairman of the board emeritus of General Mills, at his home in Minneapolis. He introduced me to a man, I've forgotten his first name. He said, "I want you to meet Mr. Pillsbury." And here was another fellow. They were both in their 80s. Pillsbury was from Pillsbury Mills. And Mr. James Ford Bell said, "Roy," or whatever Mr. Pillsbury's first name is, "I want you to meet a young man who helped establish our product." And you know, that made me feel good.
Terrific, yeah.
In 1935, at Christmas, General Mills gave me a wristwatch, which I wear to this day.
You still have it.
Merry Christmas to John Gannon from General Mills, 1935. And I wore it all during the war, and people thought I was related to the brass, but I wasn't. I was a private first class and very happy.
I'll trade you a pedometer for that wristwatch.
No. I've worn this wristwatch every day since Christmas of 1935. In the war and out of the war.
That's a wonderful memory, isn't it?
Yes.
Thanks, John.
Keeps perfect time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're talking to some familiar voices to radio listeners at Stages East today on our Those Were the Days program. We have with us at our table now George Gilbert and Anne-Marie Geyer. George was a familiar voice to listeners of Sky King. And, George, what other programs were you
involved with? Well, I worked with Sky King, Tom X, Jack Armstrong, Betty and Bob, any number of shows that I could get cast on. I don't know if you remember Freedom of Opportunity or Peter Quill or the Chicago Theater of the Air. Or actually, what I was, and it was called a freelance radio actor, which means that I had to go out and find each one of the jobs myself, get the specific producer of the program or the director of the show interested in hiring me as talent, per se. So I never occupied that enviable position of being a contract player who had a contract steady, which meant you were working every week because your character was written in every week. I would come up with juvenile toughs, Chinese, Mexican, change my voice around. I might be an old man at one time. I did character voices.
Would you? How about doing that for us? Give us a juvenile tough, a Chinese, and an old man.
Well, a juvenile tough. Let's see. All right, Louie, you think you can get away with this, but you're not going to do it, baby, because I'm ready for you all the way down the line. Now, the way we got this lined up, King and these guys are going to be there in the mine. We're going to have the dynamite in there. Or I might say, well, geez, guy, I only did it because I liked him, and I didn't know it was going to hurt anybody. Or I come in with the German, "We're not going to get Sky King if it's the last thing that we do." You know, this type of thing, or an old man, "Gibbs, idiot, you're fine as yours." Yeah, that sounds a little like Walter.
I think the Nazis really suffered at the hands of the kids' programs during the war, didn't they? Anne-Marie Geyer, you were in Chicago probably at the tail end of the time when Chicago was the heyday for radio drama, right?
Yes. Then I did, I did Woman in White, I did Chris Snyder, I did a show called Bob Becker's Pet Parade, if you remember that. I did American in the Air, there was another one, a war show. I did Ma Perkins, I did...
Were you a continuing character on Ma Perkins?
No, I was... like George, I was
you
on Woman
in
White. I had a part that was continuing.
Well, you must have been a nurse.
No, I was the daughter of the doctor.
That's close enough. Close enough. Now then you went to one of the coasts, right?
No, then I went to New York, because right. most of us did go, because the shows went to New York.
Right.
So there I worked all the shows, but the like my main thing, like George says, contract thing, was Katie's Daughter. And
Katie's Daughter was one of the really one of the later soap operas.
Right.
It was on what network was Katie's Daughter?
NBC.
And this ran from about 46 to 48.
Yeah.
And this was on in the mornings, right?
Right.
And the women would iron and launder and.
It was for Sweetheart Soap, yeah.
Sweetheart Soap.
And then I did Trudy Bauer on Guiding Light. I did that for many years in New York.
You
and
worked
then we
with Ethel Owen in Chicago, and when she went to New York.
In New York, yeah. I worked with her.
I see Ethel every once in a while on some of Bob Hope's specials.
Oh, yeah, she's on the coast now.
And
then I was on Let's Pretend for about 12 years, if you remember that.
Oh,
that
it's one of the all-time favorite
That's
kids.
That's right.
Now, you weren't Sybil, because Sybil
I,
was
I
Sybil,
wasn't
right?
Sybil Trent. I was Anne-Marie Geyer.
Right, and you were, this, of course, it was, Let's Pretend came out of New York.
New York, CBS,
right.
Gwen Davies, Jack Grimes, all those
Can you remember the Cream of Wheat song?
Cream of Wheat, I was just singing it a minute
Let's
ago.
Sing it. Let's sing it now.
All right, I'll try to remember it. I remember it, and I said, Cream of Wheat is so good to eat, yes, we have it every day. We sing the song, it makes the song, it makes the shout. Oh, right! I can't do like that. It's well, good for growing babies and grown-ups too to eat. For all the family's breakfast, it's
you,
always
you
cream of wheat.
Let's give a little round of applause.
Well, I had the opportunity. I want to commend your station on bringing back the radio broadcast that you're doing presently.
Thank you very much.
In the afternoon, I hear it at 5:45, and sometimes I hear it in the morning.
Right.
Well, I've enjoyed so much hearing some of the old-time shows that you're broadcasting there, and the opportunity of hearing some of the folks that I used to know.
That's terrific. My show was on Saturdays from 1 until 4, and we do the old radio shows, too.
Are you the Evanston station?
That's correct.
I can't get you in Chicago.
Our listeners will be glad
to
hear that.
You
called us.
Yes, the one time, and somebody wanted me to come out there for some sort of interview. But then I could never hear your show. I couldn't get it out
there. Well, we're going to send you a copy of this tape so you'll be able to hear this show.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, Bill Plant, who you met here with CBS, who's working with CBS, started as an announcer at WNNP, and at one time I used to sell for the station.
No kidding.
Station sales.
You didn't sell soap.
No, I sold radio time for WNNP.
Well, it's the old home week here at the Sage is East. With George Gilbert, who was on Sky King and so many other wonderful, great programs that we remember, and Anne-Marie Geyer, who was the queen of the soaps and one of our favorites from Let's Pretend. And she must have been a very little girl on Let's Pretend, because she's not a very old gal right now. Thank you both very much for being with us
Thank
today.
You so much for inviting us.
Thank you. We're at Sage's East, and we're talking with Shirley Bell Cole, who was Little Orphan Annie on radio way back in... I shouldn't say way back. How long ago were you a Little Orphan
it's
Annie?
Way back. From about 19, part of 1930 to part of 1940. Comes to about 9.5 years altogether.
Now, the program originated in Chicago at
yes.
WGN?
WGN. We worked at WGN in the early years, and later years when it went network, then we worked out of NBC.
I see. Was that at the Merchandise Mart?
At the Merchandise Mart, yes.
I see. And you were... Well, how can I tactfully ask? You were a teenager at the time?
Well, yeah, I got to be a teenager eventually.
Well, you were a Little Orphan.
I was a Little Orphan Annie.
For all of those listeners who want to know, this Little Orphan Annie has eyes, and you can see very well. You know, the part was taken over by a Janice Gilbert, right? Was that after you were a Little Orphan Annie?
Janice Gilbert? No. There was never a Janice Gilbert that I know.
Maybe that was a recent name, because I've got a Janice Gilbert's name in my memory book. Now, when did Little Orphan Annie go off the air?
It went off the air at the summer of 1940.
And then Ovaltine came in with Captain Midnight at that time.
That's correct.
And Little Orphan Annie was relegated to the comic pages after that.
Very true.
Right. How long did the program run, totally?
9.5 years.
Because
it started in the latter part of 1930 through the summer of 1940.
Oh, I see, I see. Now, there were many premiums, such as shakers and decoders. Do you have any of these? Do you have many of them?
I have just a few things, I'm sorry to say. I wish I had more.
You didn't send them the Ovaltine labels or anything like that to get them, I suppose.
Well, it was a little difficult getting them. There were some complications, but I do have a shake-up mug and a hot Ovaltine mug, and these have the comic strip character, such as a decal, on the face of these drinking
mugs. How about no decoders?
I do not have a decoder pin. I'm very much ashamed.
I'll trade you a decoder pin for a shake-up mug.
If I had more than one, you'd be welcome to it. It wouldn't even be a trade.
I noticed that one of the characters on the Orphan Annie show was Aha, the Chinese cook. And that was played by Olin Soule. Now, do you have a recollection of Olin Soule playing
Very much
Aha?
So. Very much so.
He was really the backbone of Chicago radio, I think, in the 30s and the 40s.
I know he worked our show quite a bit, as many other of the actors that I can remember, including this gentleman sitting to my left.
The gentleman sitting to her left is Norman Gottschalk, who played Shandu the Magician. Come on in, Mr. G.
Well, really not Shandu, but I was on the show, and Howard Hoffman played Shandu, but I like to remember it because WGN was on the top floors of the Drake Hotel at that time.
And that's very close to where we are at this very moment.
That's right. And enjoyed working Orphan Annie with Shirley. Don Gallagher and I did a couple of The only way I can remember or describe these two now is to say that they were a couple of sweet gangsters.
Almost the good guys.
Yeah, they were almost good guys, but they were gangsters. And they didn't sound like gangsters. They were just a couple of real nice guys, you know. But at heart, they were real meanies, and enjoyed the episode very much.
What other programs were you involved with?
Well, of course, I like to remember that I auditioned for Blair Wallister, who was working at WGN, and he was going to put a new show on the air called Mary Noble, Backstage Wife. The show was called Backstage Wife, and Larry Noble, the matinee idol of that era, married Mary Noble. And they were married on Monday, and what happened on Tuesday, I don't remember, but on Wednesday, he brought Mary to live in his palatial penthouse apartment in New York and introduced her to Sago, his Japanese houseboy. And for years and years, until, I believe, a Manchuria incident, I was Mary's confidant, and I was so wonderful. And then this incident came along, and animosity toward the Japanese was such that they couldn't have a Japanese houseboy anymore. They got rid of him. But I came back as a Chinese houseboy.
You know, the same thing happened on the Green Hornet program. Kato was a Japanese valet until Pearl Harbor, and then he became a Filipino.
Marvelous.
Now, I have a note that says you played Dan O'Leary on a soaper called Houseboat Hannah. Is that
right, and I loved it, and I wish that a show called The Peabodys that Fran Allison and I did, but there was Hannah and Dan O'Leary, and it was called Houseboat Hannah, and we lived on Sausalito Bay with our children, Kevin and Seamus, and our daughter Rosie, and Henrietta Tedrow, who was...
She was our Mrs. Silo.
She was Mrs. Silo on Orphan Annie. Well, she and I played Hannah and Dan O'Leary.
Now, Mrs. Silo and Mr. Silo were, of course, farmers, correct?
These were the farm folk who
right.
took care of Annie.
Right.
Annie lived with them when she wasn't traveling with Daddy Warbucks.
Right, and you got into many, as they say, many misadventures, right?
Oh, yes. You know, that was the purpose of the whole thing.
You were asking Shirley about a coder, you know, a decoder.
Yes.
And Ovaltine labels and so forth and so on. See, on Houseboat Hannah, we advertised lava soap.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think if I went down in the basement and looked in the corners, I'd still find some bars of lava soap.
Well, I've got dibs on it, if you find it.
They used to give it to us by the gross.
You also, Norman Gottschalk, were on Silver Eagle Mountie. Is that a fact?
Silver Eagle?
Silver Eagle? All my I'm getting
wasn't
a lot of bad references here, I think.
No, wasn't that in Detroit?
In the 50s. Well, maybe it was in Detroit, but it was the last big adventure series on radio in the 50s.
No, I just don't recall ever having been on it.
They had, well, you're listed.
Oh,
going.
wait a minute. Silver Eagle.
Yeah.
Don't look at me. That doesn't ring a bell.
Oh.
This is yours.
Oh. Forgive me, the man that directed the show. And he has the talent phone business here in Chicago.
James Jewell?
James. Jim.
James
sure.
Jewell?
Well, I couldn't say his name, but it was right there. Sure, he did Silver Eagle. I was on it loads and loads of times.
Okay, now I don't feel so bad. I
thought
I was looking
goodness
in a movie goodness magazine or something. Is that a radio?
I told my thing? Wife the other day I can remember anything for 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, Jewel was the fellow who produced The Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet, too.
That's right, sure.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And he's still very active today here in Chicago.
Now, what are you doing today?
Oh, different commercials.
Different commercials.
This kind and that
where,
kind.
Where do we hear your voice on TV commercials, I assume?
Well, I'm a Mars Knot for Kellogg's.
You're still working for the cereals, aren't you?
Oh, sure.
There'll always be cereals.
That's right. That's
and for Murphy Miller, why, I'm the zookeeper, and all the animals are having a sit-down strike. And they won't eat. And you know what they do? They take the food we give them and they spread it out on the floor of their cages and spell Murphy Miller. Because they want air conditioning, too. Yeah, the Monkey House got it, and now they want it.
That's showbiz, I guess. Shirley Bell Cole, what are you doing these days in 1970?
Well,
few years
as
after
I have been doing since about 1945, 46, I've been, shall we say, a homemaker. That sounds a little more glamorous than just a housewife.
Well, what does your husband think of being married to a little orphan Annie?
He kind of got used to the idea.
Are you the same chatterbox that you... that you
there are moments.
Speaking of chatterbox, do you recall the lyrics to that song?
Oh, certainly.
Would you like to give us a quick sample so we can sign off with that?
Well, you mean spoken or
oh,
sung?
We have to have a first
well,
class.
We'll give it the full treatment, huh?
Full treatment.
Who's the little chatterbox? The one with pretty auburn locks. Whom do you see? It's little orphan Annie. She and Sandy make a pair. They never seem to have a care. Cute little she, this little orphan Annie. Bright eyes, cheeks of rosy glow. There's the store of healthiness handy. Mite size, always on the go. And if you want to know, Arf says Sandy always wears a sunny smile. Now wouldn't it be worth the while if you could be like little orphan Annie?
Well, thank you very much. Shirley Bell Cole and Norman Gottschalk for spending a few moments with us today on Those Were the Days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was great fun.
Don't go early.
Grab those controls, Johnny. Ivan Shock is catching up to us.
Gosho, gee, that aficionados of Captain Midnight will recognize the voice of
Paul Barnes, who played Captain Midnight for a long time on the Ovaltine-sponsored program. Paul, how long were you Captain Midnight?
I was Captain Midnight for just a year, but I was many other characters on the show before that.
And who did you play?
I played mostly villains, actually. Characters who might not be recognized by their names today, but certainly would be recognized by their voices.
One was a Nazi, of course. He was the arch-villain during World War II, you see. Ivan Shark was only associated with him. And the thing I liked about this character particularly was he had to speak French with a Deutsch accent.
Which is not an easy thing.
No, and we actually did it. Actually spoke in French, page after page of dialogue, while there was a translator on the sidelines, you know, to tell people, you know what he said? He said so-and-so and so-and-so. And gave the translation so the kids, of course, could get it. But I actually spoke French with a German accent.
Terrific. Now, who else did you play on the program before? I know we're going to get into Captain Midnight.
Well, many other characters whose names and voices I don't remember. Just bits and pieces. Sometimes they'd go on for months at a time. But they were mostly villains.
Now,
and usually pretty rough and nasty. You know, overly nasty, as those things always are. They're cut of whole cloth, shall we say. And you're either all bad or all good in a kid's show.
Now, when you received the Captain Midnight script, how much preparation did you have before you went on the air?
Oh, we got the script, we sat down, read it around a table, then we got up and rehearsed it once on the microphone, and then we did it.
The same day?
Sure, same day. And in those days, we had a repeat for the West Coast, which we did live. We would have about a half hour off, and then we'd come in and do the second broadcast for the West Coast. There was no tape then. There was acetate recording, but acetates were uncertain at best, and the needle could jump and so on. And so generally we did them live.
I understand that when they first started with the transcriptions, of course there was no going back once you started because
that's
of
right.
That sort of thing. And many is the transcription that got 14 minutes into a 14 and a half minute program, and they.
I can remember occasions when we were doing slide films in the old days, slide film recordings. A 15-minute recording would start perhaps at noon and perhaps still be going on at noon the next day because during the last 5 seconds, because of tension, somebody would blow it. Then we'd shave the wax disc, which is what we used then, and start all over again. I can remember going through 3 or 4 of those in a session, and the wax disc, I think, was 3 or 4 inches thick. Would shave down to nothing, and then we'd start over with a nice, brand-new thick one. That's what we made our recordings on.
I think this is why so many of the great radio programs from the past are just lost forever. There
yes,
was no
are.
Way to record these things.
That's true.
It's a shame, because we're finding a whole new generation of people interested in these programs.
Well, there's another program of mine that perhaps even more Chicagoans are familiar with than Captain Midnight. Captain Midnight was known coast to coast, but a program called Calling All Detectives was on WGN in Chicago 5 nights a week for 3.5 years with no vacations.
Now, wait, let me see. Was that sponsored by an ice cream company?
No, that was not. That one was sponsored by Sealy Mattress.
Sleeping on a Sealy?
Is like sleeping on a cloud.
Right.
That's it.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And I was Jerry Browning. That's right. Jerry Browning, the detective, and all other characters in the show.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
From 6 to 14 voices per program.
Now, you're known as the Man of a Thousand Voices.
I was the original Man of a Thousand Voices, but through inadvertence didn't copyright the title, so a lot of people are using the title today. So I've dropped it. I don't bother calling myself that anymore. Instead, I'm the all-new improved Paul Barnes now. I figure after 36 years in the business, I can be all-new and improved.
Well, if you've been in the business for 36 years, you must have started when you were about 8 years old.
Bless you, I was 15, and I don't mind giving my age away.
Terrific. Paul, we really appreciate your being with us this evening, and thanks
My
for
pleasure.
Joining us at Save Disease.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're talking with Anne-Marie Geyer, who was involved for many years on the Let's Pretend program. And Anne-Marie, you played what role on that program?
Well, I did the princesses. My chief number was Cinderella, and any princess that there, I play.
Can you give us a little of your princess voice?
No, because it's just my regular voice as I speak, only I soup it up and make it sweet.
Well, that's why I mean, soup up your regular voice so we get a little soupy princess.
Well, it wouldn't, I don't know, I don't have a line here to read.
Well, tell us about the pumpkin that has just changed into a coach. That's not a princess, but that's princessy type, right?
I know. Sort of hard.
All right, we won't put you on the spot. What about some of the other people, the other names that we remember from Let's Pretend?
Well, you probably remember. Well, Sybil Trent is now a very successful theatrical agent in New York City. Jack Grimes is a very successful actor still, and he sometimes produces things. In fact, about 5 years ago, he produced a series of albums for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, children's stories. Not Let's Pretend, but children's stories. And he got us all together, and all of us pretended did them. I was living in Baltimore, and I went up to New York, and I did them. And let's see.
It must have been great fun doing those programs.
Oh, it was marvelous.
You were really, really big stuff with the other kids, weren't you? You know, I mean, as you were on the program, and the other kids would talk about you if you're on the radio. Did they know that? How about?
Well, we had a studio audience.
Yeah, no, I realize that.
For Let's Pretend, a big audience, and of course Uncle Bill. You know, he was the announcer, Bill Adams, and he came on there and talked to the kids, and the kids yelled and clapped. And
They used to get on a fire engine or something to drive to make me leave land, or
sometimes, yes.
Whatever it was like.
Yes, and there was an orchestra, and Brownie was the conductor, and Gwen Davies and Sybil Trent sang the song, the theme song. And Gwen Davies is now happily married and living in Dune Acres here.
Right here in this area.
And Nyla Mack, who was the creator and director, passed away many years ago.
The Let's Pretend program brought such great entertainment to the kids and adults too, I think, who just enjoyed kind of being transported back to make-believe land.
Yes, it was an excellent program.
Right, I remember Puss in Boots and Rumpelstiltskin.
Oh, yes,
and
Jack Grimes played Puss in Boots.
Right.
He was the puss.
Who played the boots? Yeah, that was great. Did you do any other kids' programs?
No.
Mostly,
no.
Then you were in the soap opera field.
Then the soaps. But Let's Pretend was a very close corporation. And I was on that show maybe 7 years, and I was still the new girl. Because they all had been on there since they were children, really.
What kind of, I think the statute of limitations may have run out on this, so I can ask this question. What kind of compensation, what kind of pay did you get for being on a program like that?
We got after scale.
Well, that was all right. What was that at that time?
At that time, I think it was $85.
So all of the kids, all the voices on that program were doing a heck of a lot better than the kids who were home tearing off the box tops of cream and wheat and waiting for the program to come in, I would say.
Well, they were working harder, too.
That's right. Anne-Marie Geyer, thanks very much for this little insight to Let's Pretend.
Well, thank you, sir.
Smoking in the outer lobby only.
Good evening, Mr. First Nighter. Your seat, the third one, right off aisle 3. Thank you. Here's your cab, Mr. First Nighter.
Those were familiar sounds from the First Nighter program. And we're talking with Harry Elders, who was a regular member of the First Nighter program, and as well as many other Chicago programs in the great golden age of radio as far as Chicago was concerned, right?
That's right, Chuck.
What about the First Nighter? How did you get wrapped up with that?
Well, it's hard to tell how anyone got wrapped up with any programs. I imagine, if I remember correctly, it was the result of an audition that they held for the parts that were to be filled on First Nighter, one of them being the page boy, as they called it. And I won the audition, and it was as simple as that.
Now, I understand. What was it? Am I misinformed when I say that Brett Morrison at one time was the First Nighter?
Brett Morrison was Mr. First Nighter for a good many years.
Right. And Brett Morrison, of course, was also the Shadow.
That's right. He was the Shadow. Wow, you have a good memory.
Now, the First Nighter program, which was, of course, the little theater off Times Square, actually never originated from Times Square, did it?
No, that was an illusion, and it lasted for a good many years, and I guess more letters came in from listeners saying, is the little theater off Times Square actually off Times Square, or isn't it? I don't know what the reply was to those people because they tried to preserve the illusion for a good many years and they were successful at it.
It was about 900 miles off 9
certainly
Times
was.
Square, really,
it
wasn't it?
Nowhere near.
For a time, the program then came from the West Coast, too, I believe.
No, it came from Chicago on both
totally?
On both occasions. During one period, it came from NBC, and the next period, it came from CBS.
Now, many listeners will possibly remember a program called Curtain Time, and you were the romantic lead in virtually every Curtain Time program.
That's
you?
Right, I was. And Nanette Sargent was my leading lady.
Was Burl Vaughn ever involved?
Burl
in that?
Vaughn was involved for a time on Curtain Time.
Now, I used to have a little at the opening. I remember this so well because it used to be on my itinerary every Saturday. As kids, we'd go downtown in Chicago, and we'd hit the Chicago Theater and the Oriental and get the autographs, you know, and then we'd go to the different studios and we'd drive the news directors crazy, and we'd go to the Merchandise Mart finally about 6:30, and we'd be filed in very calmly and to sit in some big studio where Curtain Time was going on, sponsored by Mars Candy Company.
That's right. I often wondered who the kids were who started that autograph sale.
That was me.
I'll trade you two for one, you know, that kind of thing.
What would we have to trade to get a Harry Elder's autograph today?
You can have those free.
Well, we'll take one, too. You remember a fellow who used to say, Curtain Time, Curtain Time.
Oh, yes, George Caesar, who's now on the West Coast.
And
George had to stand on tiptoes in order to get high enough
right,
to do that.
Right. Those were some great,
used to kid him about it.
Great programs. Everybody had a visual picture, you know, a word picture of what was happening on the air. And when you got to the studio, you kind of played it pretty well because the men were in tuxedos or dinner jackets and the ladies wore full-length formals.
That's right.
And it was a good show to see as well as to hear. And Curtain Time, how long did that run?
It ran for 5 years. 52 weeks a year for 5 years.
All new programs.
All original programs. Scripts were bought on the open market. All by budding, blossoming authors and some more firmly established in the writing field.
And that lasted for five years. From when until when?
Oh, that must have been about 1945 to 50 or 43 to 47, somewhere along there.
Now, in addition to being a featured performer on Curtain Time and getting involved with Mr. First Nighter's program, you were in any number of soap operas in the Chicago area.
Oh, yes, my. We all were. That's the way we have to make a living those days.
What about Kay Fairchild's stepmother? You were on that. You didn't play Kay Fairchild, I'm sure.
No. No, I had a run on Stepmother for months and months and months. Road of Life, Right to Happiness, Jack Armstrong, Silver Eagle.
Silver Eagle, that was the last of the great adventure shows.
That's right, that's right. A great show. A delightful show to work. It was always a challenge.
You always played a doctor, I think, on Woman in White. I have my notes say that you played Dr. Jack Landis and Dr. Preston Bradley, I don't imagine, but Dr. Bradley.
No, but I worked with Dr. Preston Bradley many a time on radio. He was quite a radio star himself.
That's right.
Dr. Bradley.
I understand that Francis X. Bushman was on Kay Fairchild's stepmother.
That's right.
And he played Kay's husband, John.
That's right, he did. He also played Chicago Theater of the Air for a good many months.
What were some of the programs that they, what were some of the shows that they presented on the Chicago Theater of the Air?
Oh, they did, a lot of the things they did on the Chicago Theater of the Air were operettas and some streamlined versions of some of the operas. They did a lot of Puccini, for example. And then they had some original plays. They used to have a lot of people contributing original dramas to the Theater of the Air. And, of course, they had a whole hour to spend so they could get a lot of mileage out of a play.
What is the most often asked question of you about the so-called old days of radio?
Well, the question that's asked most frequently of all of us is, how did you get into it? And for those who don't know anything about radio, since they're much younger than we are, my own children, for example, don't know what radio was all about because it predated them completely. For those who don't know anything about radio, they say radio must have been pretty dull at that time. You couldn't see anybody. It was all one-dimensional. You had to depend on your ear for the impression. And my contention has always been that this is what made it most attractive and most charming. The fact that it was unidimensional, that it depended solely on the ear and not on the visual impression that the person got who was listening to it.
It's certainly a great way to use your imagination. When you sit in front of the tube, you have no imagination going for you. You just watch.
Exactly, exactly.
Speaking of the tube, you're involved in a lot of things in television these days, commercial-wise and some
right.
other things. What are you doing these days?
Well, right now we're doing a series of commercials for some of the well-known national commercial sponsors around the country. We involve ourselves in these constantly, and then they're on for 13, 26, or 52 weeks. Then they go off, and we move on to something else. But in the transition period between radio and today's television, we had a couple of shows of our own here in Chicago, such as Hawkins Falls, which many of the listeners remember, Studs Place, which was an extremely interesting show. We never had a script on Studs Place. We just have an outline of the plot, and we fabricate as we went. And I think this was one of the most interesting shows that's ever been on television. And there have been many like that in Chicago. There, unfortunately, are very few left now, except the interview type, such as Cup Show and so on. We have one radio show that's still on the air in its 20th year that we're kind of proud of. It's a program called Unshackled. It's a documentary of Skid Row conversions, and it's sponsored by the Pacific Garden Mission on South State Street. And very many of the Chicago actors, many of whom are here tonight, are actors on the Unshackled program. Highly successful program on about 300 stations around the world. On several continents.
And so radio lives today.
Radio still lives today.
Radio still. And we're glad that you're a part of radio yesterday and a part of radio today. Harry Elders, thanks for being with us at Sages East today.
Chuck, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And now the director of Occidental's own Ma Perkins, Phil Bowman.
Hey, how do you remember that thing? You remember for a wash that's white without bleaching? Use Oxidol, Hustle, Bubble, Suds. I think there was something else in there, but I can't quite remember that.
Boy, that was really one of the biggest soap opera identification things in radio, wasn't it? Oxidol and Ma Perkins?
I think so. As a matter of fact, within the agency, which was then Sir Fitzgerald Sample Hummer, may I give
them Charlie, of course.
There was one small rebellious group which wanted to take this thing off. And we took it off for a few times, and somebody did a research job on it. The identification almost disappeared. So we had this opening line before the theme song.
Well, that brought on really one of the longest running soap operas since in the history of radio. You remember
how long
Ma Perkins was on the air?
No, I don't, because it was out of Cincinnati and it came before me, and then I was with it until it went to New York, and it was there for I think 6-7 years, like that.
And Phil Bowman was the director of Ma Perkins for its last 3.5 years. In Chicago, just before it went to the East Coast, as so many of the great radio shows did. What can you remember about Ma Perkins and
I can remember one thing, and I don't want this to sound like an Emmy Award or anything, but for my dough, the greatest director, the one who built this crazy thing, was a guy named George Fogle, an old ex-Marine sergeant in World War II. He was the toughest guy on the outside and the softest guy on the inside I've ever known. He's out in California today, and would you believe that this guy has a little Wednesday lunch for all the Chicago alumni at a little place on Hollywood, just off Hollywood, down on Vine. And a couple of times I've been out there at this thing, and there have been old-timers like Forrest Lewis, Vinnie Pelletier, Les Tremaine, and just ever so many of those wonderful people who used to be here in Chicago. But that's not answering your question.
When they get out to the coast, though, they have lunch with the original director of
Opera. They all go together there, yeah. I wouldn't say he was the original, but he was a long-term guy.
Oh,
you know?
I see.
Yeah. And anyway, some of the things I remember about Ma Perkins is that this was probably the greatest character performer. She was so much in character. She didn't need to, rehearse too much. But this was a problem. And the only problem I ever had with the show was that, God bless him, Charlie Eggleston is dead now, and he was shuffled. Uh-huh. And Murray Forbes, who was Willie.
Willie Toops. Willie Toops. Willie.
Willie. Anyway, I can't remember what the name was. And so these two and the rest of the cast were always there on time. But Ginny had a beautiful little fault of oversleeping.
Ma, you waited. Wait,
yeah,
a minute. You're telling
Ma.
Me.
Yeah, that's Mother
Ma,
P. Yeah.
Ma Perkins overslept.
She used to oversleep in the morning, and she'd get down there a little bit late. And it somehow, it didn't disturb me so much, but it did disturb Shuffle and Willie and some of the others who were also stars of the show.
Right.
But God bless them. They were great supporting players. But there was only one Ma Perkins.
Ma Perkins was, of course, Virginia Payne, and she was Ma for the whole...
And she was Ma for the whole duration, all the way from Cincinnati through Chicago, through New York, and all the rest of the area. Not only was she... There's a strange thing. I don't know if this happens to everybody, but her character, this benevolent, magnificent woman, Ma Perkins, kind of... sloughed off on her personality, you know?
Uh-huh.
And what did she do? But she was involved in more doggone charities and do-gooding things. She did more good in her private life. Now, whether she was that way originally and that made her a great Ma Perkins, or because the character of Ma Perkins made her this way, this I wouldn't know. But she was one of the greatest, not only performers, but one of the greatest people I think I've ever known.
I've always tried to find this out, and I've never been able to get an answer, and I'm going to keep asking until I find an answer. What was Ma Perkins' first name?
Virginia
Perkins?
Payne.
No, I know. Virginia Payne played Ma Perkins.
I don't know what her first name was.
Hey, that's a great question.
I don't have the answer.
I don't.
That's beautiful.
They always call her Ma.
And I used to call her Mother P from time to time, but I still don't know her first name. Beautiful.
Well, Paul, Phil Bowman, we're appreciative of your being with us today at Sages East and reminiscing a little bit about Mother P.
Well, that's
without
wonderful.
The first name.
And being an Evanstonian, may I wish you well at WNMP.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
We're talking about Ma Perkins tonight at Sages East, the gathering of wonderful radio personalities. And we have two featured players from the Ma Perkins series. We have Elmira Ressler and Gene David. Gene, what part did you play on the Ma Perkins series?
I played the part of Josie Julicak, which I inherited from a girl, a very fine actress, called Louise Fitch, whose voice at that time sounded almost identical as mine. And as a result of her leaving Chicago, I replaced her on the show, and I became the town drunk's daughter.
This was Josie?
Josie, and through the influence of Ma Perkins, who was played by our most capable actress, Virginia Payne, through her influence, I became a very educated young woman, very well-mannered, and enough so that I married the catch of the season, the local banker's son. And then, of course, we went into all sorts of domestic difficulties after that.
So
on and on.
Up and down. Huh? Yeah, it was quite a success story, but yet you still had marital problems, with Ma's guidance. Huh?
I think one of the most interesting things at the time was the amount of fan mail we received, with people writing in and giving me all kinds of advice, telling me I didn't owe that drunken man a thing and not to worry about my father so much and to just think of myself and go ahead and marry him. And when I developed domestic difficulties, there were so many people who would write in and sympathize. It was amazing how much they identified with the...
What was your reaction to this type of mail? The listeners... They think of you as Josie or whatever the character was, but of course you knew you weren't that character. But what was your reaction to this? Did you have a tendency to take on this, the role that you were playing, or did you have an empathy towards playing this role, or what?
No, because at the time, there were very few of us who only played one role at a time. In fact, when I was doing that, I was also playing on and off on First Nighter. I did Lights Out and did scary characters. I did a lot of bad women. In fact, I think I did the first bad woman, which would be ridiculous today. I mean, I didn't even think it was very bad.
Well, how bad was that first bad woman that you did?
Well, anyone who came between threatened a marriage. We never succeeded in breaking a marriage, but we were simply a threat. And that was as far as that went. And, of course, the era of the Midwestern gangster was very strong at the time, and we did shows like Crime Reporter, and they had a solid formula in which the bad people never won out in the end, but it would go on for quite a number of episodes.
Elmira Wrestler, you were involved in character roles on Ma Perkins as well, and what type of roles did you play?
Well, I ran a gamut. I did everything from little boys and little girls, newly born babies, to young, happy housewives.
Could we hear a newly born baby now? Would you give us a little?
Oh, if I can find some Kleenex.
So this is radio.
This is radio, yes.
We're going, ladies and gentlemen, Ma Perkins, newly born baby.
It should be a little more muffled than that.
That's terrific.
And then I did even older character parts up in the late 30s and 40s, even though I had just come here from Chicago. I mean, from St. Louis to Chicago as a child actress. I mean, a young girl actress. But they gave me the opportunity of doing a number of different types of characters. And I did, I was fortunate enough to be able to do some of the real old Oxydol commercials. Ones that were almost like a career for me and for two very capable male actors was the original Hustle Bubbles. They made a Hustle bubbling sound and the Oxydol bubbles came to life. And we had cartoon type voices that we used for that. That lasted for, I'd say, 2.5 years maybe. Every day, a couple times a day. Oh, it was.
You mean you did this for other programs besides?
Ma Perkins had the original show in the morning. It had a recorded show. It had an afternoon repeat. And then we would have a test type program in between times. So we were doing all these shows for just Ma Perkins per day.
My goodness.
It was quite a career, just the one show in itself, and then we had other commitments.
Before we started our conversation for the listening audience, you were telling me about a jingle that you did for Oxydol with a little tiny voice at the end of it.
That came after that. It was the "Let Oxydol Sparkle." And that was on Ma Perkins for about a year and a half. And then they decided to take it to New York for the Jack Smith show. And I, of course, could not commute for that. Another girl in New York did that. But then when Jack Smith came to Chicago, then I would do that show here. So it was fun. Ma Perkins.
Some real nice memories of Perkins.
Yeah.
How long were you associated, Elmira, with the program?
Until it left town. As a matter of fact, I was doing, let me see, the Oxydol, no, is it the Oxydol Sparkle commercial? Yes, I was doing that on Ma Perkins when Ma Perkins left town. And had it not been for my expecting my first of five children and my husband being situated here and not being able to transfer to New York, I have remained here.
And what are you doing today? Are you a housewife or are you involved in this?
I have continued all these years in radio and TV and films. And
where would we recognize your voice today?
Well, last winter I did a number of Long Boy Power Snow snowblow type of commercials.
He didn't play the snowblower.
And, excuse me.
Gene David, what are you doing these days?
Well, last week I did a Denver Bank commercial, which I played an elderly lady, and I finished a stint with the Encyclopedia Britannica in an educational film. I've christened a new Jacobson lawnmower.
You guys are real active with the lawn materials, aren't you?
Well, the theater scene has changed in Chicago, and commercials are, I think Chicago now is the center for all commercials down throughout the country.
As it was
tremendous market.
30 years ago for radio.
30 years ago, you really, to make it in Chicago, you had to act. I was very fortunate because I had the opportunity to direct the very first serial in television up in WBKB called This Is My Life. Commander Eddie at the time invented the dialing in of the camera. Television was in its infancy at the time, and so that I could see the transition being made, but with the equipment for movies all set up in Hollywood, they were bound to end up
ready to take it. One last question before you charming ladies leave our WNMP microphones. I've been trying to find out, I've asked everybody I can, what was Ma Perkins' first name in the serial?
I don't think she ever had one.
She was just plain Mom. Just plain Bill.
I'd love to have you ask that question of Virginia Payne. I wonder if she knew.
I doubt it.
We'll continue our search to find out what Ma Perkins' real first name
is. Maybe it'll bring back the series.
If we're lucky, it might. Thank you, Elmira Wrestler and Gene David, for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.